Hi, and welcome to the Rachel Sellers Podcast, a podcast dedicated to providing free education about all things mental health. This podcast is about ending the mental health stigma and helping people cultivate a deeper awareness and understanding of themselves. Mental health education matters, and I'm here to share with you what I've learned and what I know. I'm your host, Rachel, and I'm so glad you're here. All right, gang. So today we are diving into a whole bunch of myths. So I hope you're ready for some serious myth busting today. Today I'm going to speak truth, so much truth, and debunk some common myths about eating disorders. Why? Because knowledge is power and knowledge helps break down stigma. There are so many misconceptions out there about eating disorders. They're so misunderstood. So I'm just going to jump right in and just provide some education about what eating disorders really are and what they're not. The first myth that I'm going to speak to today is this myth that eating disorders are about wanting to be skinny. Maybe. They definitely can be. The best known environmental contributor to developing an eating disorder is our culture's idealization. That's a tough word to say. Idealization and obsession with thinness. And dieting is the most salient predictor of eating disorders in adolescence. So yes, wanting to be skinny, our culture's obsession with dieting and thinness is a huge issue, and it is one of the things that does contribute to the development of eating disorders. And eating disorders are way more complex and nuanced than just dieting. They can also, and they typically are, manifestations of unresolved trauma. From the research that we have, 1 in 4 people who struggle with an eating disorder also have symptoms of PTSD. And to be honest, you know, that study was published in 2014. I bet now if we looked at that, I bet it would be more like a ratio of like 1 to 2, honestly, if we took into account some of the other symptoms of trauma that aren't necessarily included in the DSM-5's description or version of PTSD. We're seeing this more and more about the association between eating disorders and trauma, and I'm going to do a whole episode on that. Eating disorders are coping strategies. They are ways of dealing with painful emotions and trying to control them or numb them or get rid of them. Several studies have shown that eating disorders also function as an emotion regulation mechanism. Just like what I said, eating disorders, they exist in part, of course, because this is not just like one thing causes an eating disorder. There are so many factors that go into this, but in part, eating disorders function as a way of regulating and dealing with uncomfortable feelings. Eating disorders can also be about relationships. Many people who have an eating disorder have also suffered some form of attachment trauma. That could be not having your basic needs met in childhood, having an absent parent, some form of rupture in relationships. And some studies have looked at how eating disorders might function as an attachment relationship. So in other words, I'm turning to my eating disorder in order to get that need for relationship fulfilled instead of seeking it out in social relationships. Eating disorders don't exist in a vacuum, okay? People who are suffering from an eating disorder are also likely to be suffering from another co-occurring issue or disorder. Some of those can be depression, anxiety disorders, OCD, or substance abuse. Eating disorders rarely stand alone. So, yeah, our culture's obsession with dieting and thinness and the privileging of certain bodies and these ridiculous beauty standards that we have, yeah, they've certainly led to the development and maintenance of eating disorders, but they're not the only puzzle piece at play here. And eating disorders are not only about wanting to be thin. Next myth, myth number 2, only wealthy white cisgender women have eating disorders. Okay, no, no, no. Subclinical eating disorder behaviors, including things like binge eating, purging, restricting, laxative abuse, and fasting for weight loss, are nearly as common among males as they are among females. The statistic here is about 60% females, 40% males struggling with an eating disorder. So males have eating disorders too. Eating disorders are not just a woman's issue, and the stigma, though, has made it really difficult for men to seek help and to receive treatment. More than that, transgender individuals experience eating disorders at rates significantly higher than cisgender individuals, but again, are less likely to seek or receive help. Eating disorders do not discriminate between gender nor by sexual orientation. Several studies strongly support the prevalence of eating disorders for gay, lesbian, and bisexual individuals. Like, there's so many studies. There are so many studies that support this. And eating disorders also affect people from various social economic statuses and various races. So often, I think that like white, thin women have become like the poster child for an eating disorder. And yes, white, thin women have eating disorders. I am fully recovered. I am a white, thin woman. And we have to acknowledge that there is no one body type that has an eating disorder. There's no one race or gender or ethnicity. Eating disorders do not discriminate. And yet, I'm going to talk about this here in a minute, there's a lot of barriers to care for people that don't live in a privileged body. Going to get there in a second. So one study shows that teenage girls from low-income families are 153% more likely to be bulimic than girls from wealthy families. This same study showed that Black teenagers are 50% more likely than white teenagers to exhibit bulimic behaviors such as binging and purging. A 2014 study found that rates of disordered eating have increased across all demographic sectors, but at a faster rate in males and people from lower socioeconomic statuses and older people, older women and men in their 40s, 50s, 60s. The moral of the story is that eating disorders affect a diverse group of people. All people matter and all people deserve help. And yet, there are several systemic factors and systems of oppression, like access to mental health care, weight stigma and fat phobia, and how expensive treatment is, that marginalizes certain groups of people. And this is a massive issue in the field. And there are so many therapists like myself who are doing the work of educating and advocating for people of all bodies to be able to receive and have access to quality care. All right, next myth. Myth number three, eating disorders have a quote unquote look. So I sort of spoke to that maybe a little bit in that last section. This is a little bit different though. So being or looking sick enough, quote unquote, is one of the most destructive narratives out there, and it seeks people from getting help. I've seen this in my office. I have heard clients say that no one took my eating disorder seriously because I didn't look emaciated. And that's not just that I've heard that from one client. I've heard that over and over again. So this cultural narrative that we have that you have to look sick enough to seek help from an eating disorder is very problematic. And it is partly due to a lot of misinformation about BMI. And honestly, just about health in general, okay? So several people think that because their weight, you know, according to the BMI, quote unquote, is within normal range, so I could never be struggling with an eating disorder or disordered eating. And it's just completely untrue. You can be malnourished at any weight, and you can be struggling with your relationship with food and your body at any weight. And I'm going to say that again because I think it's that important. You can be malnourished at any weight, and you can be struggling with your relationship with food and your body at any weight. Jennifer Rowland is an amazing eating disorder therapist. I've learned so much from her, and I love what she says about the BMI. She says, using BMI to determine if someone is struggling with an eating disorder is like using a magic eight ball when you're sick to determine if you need to go to the doctor. You would never do that. You would never use a magic eight ball if you feel sick to see, should I go to the doctor or not? So this is the same thing with the BMI. We need to stop using it as a measure of health, and I'm going to explain why. So I like to refer to the BMI as the BS measuring index. It's bullshit. Pardon my French. My friend Mimi Cole, she calls it the beauty myth index, which I love. It's another great option. I'm going to give you some history and some facts about the BMI to support this idea that it's dumb. So this measure was created 200 years ago by a mathematician and statistician as a way to, this guy was looking for a way to categorize people for his research. He was using it to measure general weights in different populations. So I want to teach you about a word that's super important in the research world, and it's called validity. A test or an instrument or assessment is valid if it measures what it claims to measure. I'm going to break this down. So for example, if you have a personality assessment, if a personality assessment, the one you're going to use hypothetically, if it actually measures personality and not something else, let's say intelligence, then you could say that the assessment is valid. It measures what it's supposed to measure. If you were like, I'm going to give this personality assessment, and what it actually measured was something like intelligence, it didn't measure what it was set out to measure. It was used incorrectly. So that assessment would be invalid. So it is abundantly clear that the BMI is invalid. It is not a valid measure because it is currently being used to measure something it was not designed to measure. In other words, it was never meant to be used to measure how healthy someone is. The BMI wasn't created for that purpose. Several humans, including the dude who created the BMI and then the guy who started using it to measure individual health status, because he was pressured to do so, by the way, from insurance companies, la la la, both of these men said it was a bad idea. They both thought it was a bad measure. And yet, it is still used widely in the world, in doctor's offices. We teach it in health class. This is problematic. Here's another fun fact about the BMI. Well, it's not fun. It's sad. But in 1998, the World Health Organization decided randomly to lower the BMI. What that meant was that they changed what it meant to be overweight. And this literally happened overnight. So people who went to bed, quote unquote, healthy, according to the BMI, woke up, quote unquote, unhealthy, not because anything about their body changed, but because the standards changed. And so now those, quote unquote, unhealthy people freaked out and decided to diet to lose weight when it wasn't at all necessary. These people were totally healthy and fine. And what's fascinating, if you dig into this, if you dig into why the World Health Organization did this and who funded it, that's always a question you have to ask in research, especially, but even just in public policy, who's funding it? The makers of a weight loss drug funded this change, which is really fascinating, but it also makes sense because what better way to increase sales for the diet industry than to convince people that they are unhealthy when their bodies are actually fine and completely healthy? We have to understand that the diet industry doesn't actually care about our health. They care about and want our money. And it took me a really long time to learn that and to realize that. But I am, after I've dug into the research, after I've really learned the facts, the things that the diet industry doesn't actually want us to know, the fact that diets fail, they have a 95% failure rate. Diet companies don't want us to know that. Anyways, I'm going on a tangent. Back to the BMI here. Recent studies have indicated that several people with BMI levels at the low end of normal are actually less healthy than those now considered quote unquote overweight. Again, diet industry doesn't want you to know that because again, if they can convince you that you're overweight and unhealthy, then they can get your money if you do their diet. Let me give you some facts. people with a BMI of 25 to 29.9, which is often considered quote unquote overweight, live longer than people with a BMI of 18.5 to 24.9. People with a BMI of greater than 30 live at least as long as those with a BMI of 18.5 to 24.9. AKA overweight people live at least as long and frequently longer than normal weight people. And more people die from guns, alcohol, or car crashes per year than from being obese. Yeah. Quick aside here. Maybe you're thinking, okay, if the BMI is BS, which hopefully by now I've convinced you that this is true, how do we measure the severity of someone's eating disorder? There is an amazing clinic in Denver called the Gaudiani Clinic. Dr. Jennifer Gaudiani is amazing. She wrote a book called Sick Enough. It's fantastic. She's doing amazing things to get quality medical care to people suffering from eating disorders. She is positing this idea that calculating weight suppression, which is how many pounds a person has lost from their highest ever weight to their current weight, is actually a more accurate measure of the severity of their illness. And what we see from the research is that weight suppression of even 5% in the presence of anorexia nervosa symptoms has been found to be clinically significant. Oftentimes, you know, I'll meet with families and you know, the mom or dad will say, you know, I see some symptoms, maybe struggling with an eating disorder, but you know, we recently got her labs done and her labs look totally normal. You can be struggling with an eating disorder and still have totally regular looking labs. That's because our bodies are so genius and will do anything for us to keep us alive. So this is just a quick note that even normal labs can't tell the severity of an eating disorder. A couple of the tests that do would be things like metabolic testing. That is going to show whether or not the body is using protein stores for energy instead of fat, and then bone density scans and an EKG. So I know that was a bit tangential, but there's so much there. Honestly, I probably should have done a whole episode here on the BS of the BMI, but here's the point. The BMI is a stupid and an invalid measure of someone's health, and eating disorders don't have a look. BMI tells you nothing about someone's health and eating behaviors. It just doesn't. Eating disorders come in all shapes and sizes. Fat people and skinny people have eating disorders. And if you have not heard anything from this section, from this myth, I want you to know that you cannot tell if someone has an eating disorder based on their body size or quote unquote look. You can't. You cannot tell. And so we have to be really careful with our assumptions. And this goes for so many things. You never know even a slice of someone's story simply by looking at them. All right, diving into our next myth here. A lot of people believe that eating disorders are a choice. And that is a myth that has got to be debunked. Eating disorders are not a choice. Those who struggle with restrictive eating disorders are not simply vain, and those who struggle with binge eating do not lack willpower. Eating disorders are biopsychosocial illnesses. Let me break that down. That means that several genetic, biological, environmental, psychological, and social elements all play a part in the development and the maintenance of eating disorders. Eating disorders can be life-threatening mental illnesses, and they have the second highest mortality rate of any mental illness, surpassed only by the opioid epidemic. This statistic, this next one, is pretty sobering. Every 62 minutes, at least one person dies as a result of an eating disorder. So no, an eating disorder is never a choice. Something that I hear a lot, though, and I think is important to address here, is that people will say, well, wasn't it a choice to restrict food in the first place? Wasn't it a choice to diet? And I totally understand where that comes from. A lack of education and awareness can often lead people to wonder this. So I want to explain it. So while some eating disorders may develop out of a deliberate choice to improve health, quote unquote. So things like losing weight, eating healthier foods, cutting out certain food groups. For people predisposed to eating disorders genetically, these choices that seem totally harmless quickly become obsessive and can spiral out of control. And by the time someone's behaviors have escalated to the point of an eating disorder, they don't have many choices in their actions anymore. And this is why it can be really harmful when friends or family members who don't understand the nature of the disease tell someone in the depths of anorexia to just eat, or someone struggling with bulimia, just don't purge. If it were so easy, I promise you that they would. There's actually been a decent amount of research done implying that genetics plays a really important role in eating disorders. So some researchers have found anorexia to be associated with genetic abnormalities related to chromosome 12, and other studies have posited that the chance of developing anorexia is 50 to 80% genetic. So I don't know too much about the specific studies that are being done on other types of eating disorders as it goes, you know, as it relates to genetics. But what I do know is that there's a ton of research happening right now looking at how genetics influence the development of eating disorders. I think another thing to note here is that temperament type, personality also plays a role. So if you are, let's say, genetically predisposed to an eating disorder and you tend to have a more neurotic, obsessive type A even personality, and then something in the environment triggers, let's say, you know, you grew up in a family where dieting is a really big thing. You decide to go on a diet yourself. Some sort of environmental factor can trigger the onset of an eating disorder. And what we can see is like it's genetic, the genetic component, the temperament trait component, and then the environmental component here kind of can all puzzle piece together to possibly lead to someone having an eating disorder. So one way that I like to say this is that genetics can tend to load the gun and environment can pull the trigger for someone who's predisposed genetically. So I want to finish this section with this quote from Evelyn Tribal. She is the queen. She's the creator of intuitive eating. She is amazing and knows so much about eating disorders. And I love what she says about this. She says that no one wakes up one day and says, "Hey, I'm going to have an eating disorder." It's a slow descent into hell. And she's right. It is a slow descent. It's a slow descent into feeling completely overwhelmed and trapped in your own mind and feeling honestly very misunderstood. So while an eating disorder is not a choice, what we know is that recovery, for the most part, is a choice. And of course, there's some systemic barriers, things like oppression and discrimination that make it very difficult, almost impossible for some people to be able to choose recovery. So there's a little bit of nuance there. But in part, generalizing this, recovery is a choice, but having the eating disorder in the first place was never a choice. The last myth that I want to speak to is about binge eating. So there's this myth that people binge or people have binge eating disorder because they lack willpower. And that is completely false. So binge eating is primarily biological, neurobiological. It is our body's way of telling us something important. The most common reason that people struggle with binge eating is actually, and surprisingly, because of restriction. Whether that is emotional restriction, so emotion suppression, or physical restriction, restricting food intake. So when a person restricts their food intake and doesn't get enough energy, the body does what it was biologically designed to do. It signals to the body that it is in danger and it'll go to great lengths to keep it safe and alive. So binge eating is ironically and actually the body's way of saying, hey, I need more. And we don't realize that. People don't realize that. So I want to give you some education around what actually happens when the body isn't getting enough food, which leads then to the binge. So I want to teach you a new word maybe you haven't heard before. The word is leptin. And leptin is a hormone. It's the fat storage and the appetite hormone. We all have leptin in our bodies. And leptin in the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is the part of the brain that controls your appetite and your food intake. Leptin and the hypothalamus are like buds. They each have a walkie-talkie and they talk back and forth to each other a lot. And when food intake is being restricted, the hypothalamus, that part of the brain that is in charge of appetite and food intake, communicates to leptin to increase cravings for high energy foods. Makes sense. When we're deprived, when we're not eating, when our body needs fuel desperately, of course we're going to reach for high energy foods, right? The brain is just doing this to protect us. The brain's not, you know, you're not going to increase cravings for carrots when you're starving. Your body is going to drive up that leptin and increase that craving for things that are high energy. And this is why the body cannot tell the difference between a literal famine and dieting. And our bodies will do miraculous things to keep us alive. We live in a culture that teaches us to be so self-critical of our bodies. And do we ever really stop and say thank you for the amazing ways that they keep us protected and keep us alive? In many ways, binge eating is an adaptive coping mechanism that serves people really well until it doesn't anymore. The cycle is a little bit like this. Food restriction leads to a preoccupation with food, obsessing over food, which can sometimes lead to binging, which leads then to compensation. Oh no, I just binged. I ate all this food. I am feeling guilty and ashamed, so then I'm going to punish myself to restrict again. This is the diet cycle, and it is a vicious cycle, and a lack of willpower has literally nothing to do with it. So again, not having enough willpower isn't the problem. The whole system and structure of dieting is actually the problem. The most primal parts of your brain, your basic need for food, will always override the more rational parts of your brain, like the prefrontal cortex, where things like willpower exists. So you may be able to override your body's natural and primal drive temporarily. This is why dieting does appear to work in the short term. This is why people like love to promote their weight loss, blah, 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 because it does work in the short term. You can override your body's that primal natural drive for food. But usually and ultimately, and what we see with binge eating disorder is that biology is always going to win. Again, this is because our bodies are so dedicated to keeping us safe and to keeping us nourished. So I think that there's this, you know, another myth that it's only that fat people struggle with binge eating disorder. And that's just not true. There is no body size or shape associated with binge eating disorder. Binge eating disorder is also the most common eating disorder. I think I might have mentioned that in the first episode. It is over 3 times more common than anorexia and bulimia combined. Eating disorders are real and they're valid, and it's so important to be informed and educated about what they are and what they're not. I can guarantee you that you know someone in your world, whether you are aware of it or not, who has struggled or is struggling with an eating disorder. And so being aware of these things, even if you don't personally struggle, is really important. I think it matters. And it also matters because we need to break down stigma and we need to end the stereotyping and we need to have a more true and robust picture of what eating disorders really are. So I want to quickly recap things that you learned today. You learned that eating disorders are much, much more than just wanting to be skinny. You learn that they're much deeper than that and they're more complex than that. You learn that eating disorders don't discriminate between things like gender, sex, race, socioeconomic status, or ethnicity. You learn that eating disorders don't have a look. You cannot tell if someone is struggling with an eating disorder by looking at them. Even if a person doesn't look quote unquote emaciated, they can still be malnourished and they can still be medically at risk and they can still have a serious eating disorder. You learn that BMI is BS and that we shouldn't be using it to measure the severity of someone's eating disorder or someone's health, to be honest. You also learn that eating disorders are not a choice and that people binge eat most of the time. Again, this is a generalization, but most of the time because of their biology, not on account of some deficit in willpower. And I say not all the time because there are other reasons that binge eating occurs. We just know from the research that more often than not, the number one thing that tends to cause binge eating is restriction. Thank you for listening. Next episode, we are going to be diving into the association connection and connection between trauma and eating disorders. Y'all know this is my thing. This is my topic. This is what I love. And so I am super excited to dive deeper into this and provide some even more awesome education. Thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you learned something new. Just a reminder that this podcast is about mental health and mental health concepts, and education about psychology and therapy is not a substitute for individual therapy. If you want to help this podcast grow and get it into the hands of other listeners, please subscribe, rate, or leave me a review. It really does make a difference.